welcome to the Mentors Podcast, where we meet the men and women who mentored Western civilization. This is Dr. Roseanne Welch. For more information, visit mentorsproject.org. Today's guest is Kate Fulliai, author of Fermi's Gifts, a novel based on the life of Enrico Fermi, known as the architect of the nuclear age and for his work on the Manhattan Project during World War II. We're very excited to be talking about him because he had such an important influence in American history. And so we'd like to find out more about why he matters. So that's always my first question. Why do you think he matters in our history today?
Many people know, if they know about Enrico Fermi, he's kind of called the architect of the atomic bomb. And to try to kind of pull that apart a little bit, I think he was the man who J. Robert Oppenheimer and Leslie Groves, who were the physicist who was the head of the Manhattan Project, and Leslie Groves was the military man who was the head of the Manhattan Project. And I think they turned to him always in their work when they were furiously putting together the atomic bomb in Los Alamos to answer the unanswerable. Whenever questions came up that nobody could answer, they turned to Enrico Fermi because he was one of the only physicists in the 20th century really that had expertise as an experimental physicist and a theoretical physicist. And usually physicists specialized in one or the other. So I think he matters because he was the person they turned to and the person that ultimately, one of the major figures that helped develop and create the possibility for that, for the atomic bomb.
That's so interesting because usually when we think about the atomic bomb, we hear Oppenheimer sometimes, but the big name always seems to be Einstein when in fact he's not really the focus of that history.
That's absolutely true. We all know Einstein because of the theory of relativity, and he actually played a very small part, although he did play an interesting part in that when fission was first discovered, physicists in America and Europe knew exactly what that was going to lead to ultimately. And it was their job to explain what the significance of that was, as well as convince the military that it was of massive importance. And this happened, fission was discovered in 39. We all know what was happening in 39. The world was massing for war. So these physicists, many of whom were foreign born, they were Hungarian, they were Italian, they were Danish, they knew immediately what it meant, but they had to go about explaining to the government and military people what it meant. And they felt intrinsically that they probably wouldn't be listened to because they weren't as well known and they were also foreigners. So there's a crazy story that he was a Hungarian physicist named Leo Szilard, and he was crazy about this and he knew the significance of what fission meant. He insisted that they try to get the attention of the president. And the only way they could figure out to do that was to get Einstein to write a letter because they knew that they would listen to Einstein. So you had Szilard and I think it was Edward Teller, who was another Hungarian physicist, one morning in August, I think it was 1939, they didn't have his address and he lived out on Long Island. And they drove in this crazy kind of car, driving all over Long Island, literally searching for Einstein. And the story goes, they finally drove up this lane and there was a little girl with blonde braids. And they said, does a man with white hair that kind of sticks out live? And she said, oh yeah, he lives up the street. And sure enough, they found Einstein in his modest home on Long Island. And they explained what their mission was. And he immediately sat down and wrote a letter. And ultimately, it took a while. Ultimately, they did get to Roosevelt, but I think it was about 2 months later because Hitler invaded Poland, I think September 1st, and I think by October 10th or so, Roosevelt read the letter and he got it. He got it pretty immediately. But anyway.
That's fascinating. Yeah, because the idea that, well, first of all, it sounds like a movie, Searching for Einstein.
Yes, exactly.
I can see that.
Right.
But I never thought about the concept that being foreign born, they would be afraid the government wouldn't trust them.
That's absolutely right. And furthermore, Fermi himself was, I mean, there's this bizarre catch-22 where he immediately started going back and forth between his home in New Jersey and the University of Chicago, which had a lot of physicists, and there was a lot of early work being done. But because initially he was an alien, he couldn't tell the office in Trenton, New Jersey, where he was going or why. So he had to go through these hoops to get the permission to travel to Chicago, but he couldn't tell them why. And his wife, Laura Fermi, said, "Oh my God, this is so annoying, you know, but he said, "No, I have to keep the secret." And he was very patriotic, and he understood why he had to keep the secret. But yes, there was a lot of that went on.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah.
And so sad to think, because they were so important to what we needed, and yet here we were using the same thing against them that had happened in their home countries.
Exactly. Yes, yes. And Fermi had just arrived in America, because he came in 1939. He received the Nobel Prize, and his wife was Jewish. And so he had kind of predicted this for years, but the anti-Semitic decree came out. They knew it was time to leave. So he, quote unquote, went to Sweden to get the Nobel Prize, but they knew they were never going to come back. So they went to Sweden, he got the Nobel Prize, and then they immediately went to America. And he landed there in, I think, early January 1939. And then Niels Bohr, who was a physicist, came about a month later and said fission had happened. So
I can't imagine that. And clearly, we let him in because we knew he was a man of importance and we needed him.
Absolutely.
He didn't have issues with immigrating?
Yes. Yes. Well, he wrote letters kind of in secret and mailed them at different mailboxes. When this decree came out and Laura Fermi, they knew they had to leave. He wrote to University of Chicago, I think Berkeley, and Columbia. And Columbia hired him immediately. So he went to Columbia and obviously was welcomed there. So
that was very smart of them, obviously.
Yes.
that makes you crazy. So we're establishing that he left Italy because of these racial laws.
Right.
He saw what was happening with Mussolini and Hitler. And
yes.
Amazingly, he saw that some people didn't have that opportunity.
Right, exactly. Wow. And Laura Fermi's parents and family were left in Italy. I don't think she ever saw her parents again. And they had two young children when they came to America.
Did they ever have further children or?
No, it was just the two.
So they were Italian kids who became American when they moved.
Absolutely, yes. And Fermi himself had two siblings. He was very, very close to his brother. His brother, I think, was 2 years older than he. And his brother was very, very outgoing and kind of the family charmer. And his mother, I don't know if she said it, but she definitely favored him. He died tragically as a result of, I think it was misplaced anesthesia or something. And so he died tragically, and Fermi's mother was never the same. And they sort of were so engrossed in their grief, they didn't realize what a brilliant young son they had. And it took Fermi's father, who had a friend that recognized his brilliance and said, "You realize you have a prodigy." And his parents kind of hadn't, you know. So he was raised with very, very, very practical parents, very, very, very unpretentiously. And I think that was a hallmark of his personality always. He was very funny, very witty, and extremely unpretentious. And also, you might be surprised, but he was not the bookworm, the pale-faced bookworm sort of. He was very athletic, extremely, extremely competitive in everything he did. He loved to hike and fish and play tennis, and he was extremely physical and always very, very, very competitive in a fun way.
The fun part is what we don't expect about scientists.
Exactly, yes.
But also, yes. He was humorous. He liked to enjoy a good joke.
He enjoyed a good joke. He was invited to the Dolomites for a vacation when he started. He started as a professor at the University of Rome, and he was 25 years old, so it was pretty unusual. And several of the other professors expected to sit on the porch and discuss theories and so on and so forth, and he was always off hiking. And he would take young children, teenagers on these hikes, but he would also shoot questions at them as they were hiking about science and life. And so he would take them on these, you know, like 16-mile hikes, and then shoot questions and teach them. And of course, you know, their parents loved that, you know.
So much better than sitting in a classroom and talking about things and being bored. That's wonderful. And it blended both the athleticism and the health, which I know was part of the understanding of the day, that it was important to be physically active.
Yes, you know. Exactly. Yeah, he had a tremendous amount of stamina always. And and that was one of his teaching methods. And I think people nowadays, because there are many open classrooms and the idea of discussing things with your students, I think we forget that's a relatively new methodology. And when he became a professor, that was always his way of doing things. He would bring to the classroom questions he himself was dealing with, and then he would shoot the question out. And he didn't care if you were a graduate student or a professor or someone who had just walked off the street. So they had these lively discussions and classrooms. And in fact, when he started as a professor, some of the other ones, that one of the heads of the Department of Physics at the University of Rome, named Losordo, was just horrified by this. He thought it was disrespectful, and he thought it was loud, and he was always telling them to quiet down and shut up and so on. But of course, he lit a fire in all of his students, and they became the core of people that helped him start his initial research, which led to his Nobel Prize. Some of them were younger physicists, but they all became just completely turned on by physics because of Fermi. So that was always a hallmark of who he was. He had a great way of bringing people together and bringing out the best in them.
It's so progressive, so much matching, as you said, the way that people are seeing teaching needs to be done today. And still mm-hmm. there are people saying, no, that's odd and strange and I don't want to do that. And yet it is the way we have. There are studies that show more is remembered when students have their hands involved in the process and thinking through it, as opposed to being lectured to.
Exactly. And he never, ever, he rarely lectured. And there were other, you know, people that taught that way. And he was always very, you know, unpretentious about it and said, oh, well, that's way beyond me or whatever, which, of course, wasn't the truth. But that is never the way he taught. And after the war, when he went from Los Alamos to the University of Chicago, you know, he continued to teach in that way, and he had legions of students who just loved him and admired him.
Were there any famous students that came from his classes? Any other future scientists that you ran into in your research?
This man named Maury Gell Mann was a favorite student, and I think was with him, I think, in the hours before he passed away. And so there were many, many, many.
Fascinating. Interesting, we think about scientists doing their science, and we forget that the way they fund themselves to do that is to work as teachers, as professors, and that's an entirely different skill.
Exactly.
That's
right.
So wonderful that he was so good at that. The other thing that we're thinking about is, what was the most interesting thing that you think you found about him? Something you didn't expect would be true of him, or some cute little fact from his history that struck you as being unique?
I will say I do not come from the world of science. I come from the world of the arts and performing and so on. So maybe in a way I was an interesting person to pick to do this, because I certainly knew who he was, but I guess I expected him to be more of a drier and not so humorous and eccentric as a person. And I think I was very lucky that his wife, Laura Fermi, wrote a wonderful book, a memoir called Adams in the Family. It's incredibly charming and very funny. And, you know, he was just very eccentric and you know, and charming. I mean, I really did fall in love with him, and I didn't expect that. I mean, I expected the brilliance. I expected probably not to understand half of what he did or how he did it. But I did not expect someone who was so completely unpretentious and humble on the one hand, and very funny on the other. The first car he bought was this. They said it looked like an Easter egg on wheels, and he drove it all over Rome and, you know, sort of courted his wife-to-be in this ridiculous car. And he was late to his wedding because he was also somebody that believed in doing things yourself. So he did not believe in hiring. He believed everybody should work equally. And so he, for example, when they were building the pile in Chicago, he was actually hauling, and someone came to see him. I think Leslie Groves came to see him, and he couldn't find him, and he crawled out from under, you know, this huge pile of graphite, because they had graphite and then wood and the cadmium rods, and they were building this. And he was hauling things along. I think they hired the University of Chicago, or, you know, football athletes to haul some of these blocks, but he did it himself because he did not believe. He believed everybody should work equally. So I think those things about him were things I didn't expect. And those are traits that as a person, I really admire. I really admire people who pitch in and do the work. And I admire people who are unpretentious, especially when they have reason not to be.
True. If they have reason to be pretentious, it's okay.
But. Right. It's, yeah, exactly. And so I think those are the things that surprised me the most, that I did not expect to find out about him, you know.
Well, you make me excited about reading more about him.
I'm glad.
Because he sounds like a human being as opposed to just a lecture.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, that is absolutely right. I think one of the most interesting parts of learning about him was you could probably spend your whole life researching the Manhattan Project and Los Alamos and the world of Los Alamos. And I think, you know, there's been films and TV shows and so forth about it, but I think it'd be really interesting to do one about just about the life at Los Alamos. And how so many of the people, so many of the families, and it was true of Fermi's family, they were at the University of Chicago. People, it was called Site Y. They had no idea. And Fermi had been traveling all over to Hanford, Washington, and Oak Ridge, Tennessee, and down to Los Alamos. And his family had no idea where he was or what he was doing. And they just got three tickets to Lamy, New Mexico. And they were told to pack up all their stuff. And they got on a train, and they ended up there. And then they were taken by a GI to Santa Fe. They had no idea where they're... I mean, can you imagine? Can you imagine? I mean, they had no idea where they were going or why. And then they were driven 30 miles up this... straight up this mesa to Los Alamos. Many of them... The Fermi family, Laura Fermi and her two children, went from a Victorian house near the University of Chicago to a tiny hut with, and there was a, at Los Alamos, there was a beautiful street called Bathtub Row. And they called it Bathtub Row because that's where the important, the VIP people who were working at Los Alamos got to stay. And they were going to give one to Fermi. And because And he said, no, I don't want to be singled out. Now, of course, his wife may have felt differently, but literally, so they went from their Victorian home, got on a train, driven up to the Mesa, and they were dumped off in this, you know, and there was garbage overflowing, laundry hanging out. The furnace, when you turned it on, blasted out soot. Half the time, there wasn't water. And they were there for, I think, 2 years. Some people were there, had been there longer. And, of course, they had no idea what their husbands were doing. One woman, Leona Wood, did work too, but it was mainly males. And also, Los Alamos was a combination of military personnel and European eggheads, or that's what they called them. It was a very strange combo of, you know, you had GIs and then you had Edwin Teller, who was playing sonatas in the middle of the night. You know, very extremely brilliant and eccentric people, all kind of caged in on this mesa. And I actually went there. And
I was going to ask you about that. I know that you actually went there for research.
Yes,
so what was
yes.
that like?
Oh, it was so it was so moving. There was a woman named Dorothy McKibben who lived in Santa Fe, and she was sort of like the welcome wagon. She was where everybody, you know, would come through, and she was this amazing personality who apparently trained a tortoise to serve people drinks on its back. You know, I mean, you know, there were some really eccentric things going on there. And she would be the welcome wagon and, you know, say, well, you're going up to this mesa, I've assigned you an apartment, and, you know, it'll take about an hour or whatever to get up there. And so I went, and it's, of course, Los Alamos is very different, looks very different than it did then, but some of the places and houses and apartments have been preserved.
Wonderful.
And so it's a fascinating place to go. It really is. The other thing is Oppenheimer and Leslie Groves, when they chose Los Alamos, they had the choice of, they were thinking about a valley, but Oppenheimer said, these people are going to be caged in here on this mesa, and they won't be able to get off, some of them, for 4 years. They need to have something beautiful to look at. So it is very, very beautiful. And there are there are canyons that you can access that we actually did, where there's petroglyphs and ancient paintings, you know, cave paintings and cave dwellings. Lots of times that's where the physicists in particular would take long walks. And so we did that. We were there right near Halloween. And they had the statues of Oppenheimer and Leslie Groves dressed up with weird hats. But anyway, we went on this hike, and there was no one else there. And this canyon felt ancient and amazing, and it was easy to imagine Fermi and one of his colleagues, Emilio Segre, walking through and discussing, you know.
Fascinating. So. And now you remind me, of course, thinking of the names of the different colleagues. How did they all, at what point did he learn English? At what point were they able to relate to each other since they had different languages and yet they had the science that they shared? How did they manage this communication on such a distinctly specific information? It wasn't just, hello, where's the library?
Right, right. Well, I think going back to Italy, one of the other interesting things about Fermi is he always believed from a very early age in sharing information with colleagues. And that wasn't the case, strangely enough, or not maybe not strangely enough, like mm-hmm. in Germany, that was not the case. That was not the feeling. The feeling was not that you shared things. The feeling was that you kind of, you know, kept things to yourself. But Fermi and people who came after him believed in sharing information between colleagues. Fermi himself, a lot of them, in answer to your question specifically, learned other languages. So Fermi learned German. I think he was able to read German. And because at the time, when Fermi was younger, Germany was the
Mecca.
The
in
Mecca.
Some way.
Right,
right.
Exactly.
Especially for intelligence, for universities, for progress.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's such a strange truth, but it's true.
Yes. No, that is very true. And he received a fellowship one winter to go and study with, I think his name was Max Born, a physicist. And it was just a horrible experience. It was unlike, you know, it was totally unlike his collegial way of working. And it was very much go stay in your own place and do your thing. And he hated it. He didn't like it at all. But they learned other languages, and Fermi had been studying English assiduously so that he would be able to. And he had a colleague named Herbert Anderson at Columbia who helped him. And he always wanted to lose his accent more than he did. He had a pretty heavy accent. He tried to lose his accent, but he was moderately successful at that, but he was able to understand and speak English very well.
Wonderful. And so, just on a side note, was Laura, did she then also learn?
She absolutely did, but it was, you know, she was brought to America. Fermi spent several summers at Ann Arbor, Michigan, with other groups of physicists before they finally moved. So in the 30s, they had been to America before. She was very, very brokenhearted about having to move to America, and I think it took her a while. They were in the Columbia community, and they eventually moved kind of across the river to Leonia, New Jersey. And she was just getting, you know, settled there when they had to move to the University of Chicago, you know. So, and I think she eventually came to love America, but there were aspects of it that she found, you know, the pace of it, especially in New York, very difficult. She didn't understand canned food, although Fermi loved it, because he said that he loved the idea of vacuum-packed food. And one of his favorite things was step-on trash cans. He thought those were fantastic.
Well, you can invent nuclear reactors, and you think a step-on trash can is fascinating.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
That's adorable.
Yeah. He also, this was a little bit later in life, but he, when they moved back to the University of Chicago, he loved square dancing. And so apparently he was not particularly graceful, but he, nor was he particularly graceful with tennis, and his form wasn't great, but he was very, you know, he was very strong. And so he loved square dancing, and they had square dancing parties at their house at the University of Chicago. And his only, and I think he and his daughter would kind of make the guest list. And his only caveat was that no snobs be invited.
It makes sense. The square dancing is very similar. Obviously, any folk dancing from any country has a similarity to it. So maybe that gave him a sense of being at home, being part of his own tradition in this new place.
Yes, exactly. And he loved good food, and he had a very strict schedule. He was up very early, you know, and got to work early. And, you know, there's an apocryphal story that when they were finally in Chicago, when they were doing the final experiment, he insisted that they stop. So they were pulling out these cadmium rods, you know, to see when they would. And he said, it's noon, let's go and eat. And everybody was kind of like, are you kidding me? So they stopped. They left the rods where they were. They went to eat. And
there's something to be said for structure.
Exactly.
In life, in writing, I'm sure in scientific studies, it makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, that's adorable. That's so interesting. Okay, so let's think about the writing process. And is there, because you had a lot of good research, but was there anything that you had to finesse in order to move things along? Or was there a scene that you found very enjoyable to create?
I think the science part of it and the physics part of it were things that I had to ask experts about. My husband has a friend who is a writer and a physicist, Andre Bormanis, who wrote on Enterprise, Star Trek Enterprise, and he's a wonderful guy and very, and like Fermi, and I should say this very clearly, that one of his greatest talents was making the complex simple. And that's one of the, you know, so I would say Andre Bormanis did that for me. He explained protons and neutrons and fission. And so I think that was a challenge for me, but very interesting. And I think I really loved the writing about Los Alamos and that whole, you know, that I found that whole situation very interesting. And I think also the conflict between the scientific community and the industrial community and the military. And they all had to come together eventually to do this. And it was I found that very fascinating. They did come together because of people like Fermi. I think, you know, Oppenheimer and Leslie Groves too, but, you know, many, many people had to come together and in some cases put aside their own personal feelings and feelings of conflict and disagreements in order to put this all together.
It became about the project more than about their own individual egos.
Exactly. And I think, you know, and there are many, 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 many moving aspects to it. I mean, one of his colleagues, Emilio Segre, both of his parents were taken away to concentration camps and never seen again. And I think so many people working on this had very, very deeply personal reasons for doing it. Leona Woods, one of the physicists I've mentioned before, when they realized after they did the test of the atomic bomb at Alamogordo, which I think was July 16th, 1945, I think it was a profoundly disturbing event for everyone there, everyone who saw it, or it affected different people differently. But she, Leona Wood, for example, had two brothers who were on ships waiting to attack Japan. So she was very anxious for that to happen. Other physicists, there was a spectrum of reaction, as you might imagine, and other physicists suddenly felt very differently.
How did Fermi feel about what they had created?
He I think in every instance, everything I've researched, he did not ever regret for a second his research and his work. Even his own daughter, you know, at later in the 50s and 60s at the University of Chicago, questioned him and said, you know, and he himself did not ever express a regret about it. He did, however, work on the Atomic Energy Commission, and, you know, because after the bomb was dropped and the reality of what occurred and the consequences of it, many people changed their minds or wanted to work toward world peace. Fermi was not a big believer in that world peace was ever going to happen.
Didn't believe it was possible.
He
would like it to be, but he didn't yet.
Right. It's interesting, however, that his granddaughter put together this amazing book of photographs of Nagasaki and Hiroshima and is a huge proponent of peace and finding, you know, ways to avoid nuclear disaster. So it's interesting.
Very interesting. Yeah. That would, of course, it's the family history, so you've got to take a side on it.
Right.
You've got to make a choice about it.
Right.
Wow. Mm-hmm.
But in answer to your question, I did not ever find in my research that Fermi himself questioned it or regretted it.
It was a scientific discovery, and it was going to be made, and it was certainly better than it was made by the good side than the other side, so I can see why that would be a reality.
Right.
And there was the difference between discovering it versus how it's used, and that wasn't something they were in charge of, so I can see being able to separate that out.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. And after the bombs were dropped, then there became, you know, a whole... People were, again, very divided as to who should be in charge of what happened in the future. And then you had the McCarthy era, too. So...
Didn't help.
Right.
Didn't help
yes.
at all. Why was Fermi chosen for the Manhattan Project? Just because of the Nobel Prize, because of his earlier research, there were many scientists to choose from.
Well, there were a lot of people that worked on it, so he certainly was not the only one, but I think that he was known to be an expert both as an experimental physicist as well as a theoretical, and I think his personality, you can imagine, I mentioned another Hungarian physicist, Leo Szilard, and he was this quite eccentric, but very, apparently by all, very brilliant, but extremely voluble and extremely overdramatic and extremely kind of off the charts. And Columbia, for example, wanted to hire him, and they got him for like 3 months, but he was just so crazy that in his habits and his... So you can imagine military men, all of whom, I think all the three people from the military that were, you know, running this were all West Point grads, sitting down with somebody like Leo Szilard, you know. So they tried to find the person, the physicist that they knew that was A, brilliant, theoretical and experimental, and also had a personality that was calm and that was Fermi. And he also had the ability to take complex things and explain them in a simple way. And so I think all of those combinations pointed to this man was absolutely the person for the job.
I love that idea of being able to take complex things and report them to other people in simple ways so that it could be understood, because otherwise, what's the point? You could go on and on about something you know, but if you can't make it understood, which is the essence of teaching.
Yes, and actually, if you want to think about it, I mean, I think it was a man, Arthur Compton, and I think he was the one that was tasked with going to FDR, actually sitting down in a meeting with FDR, and Fermi was the one that coached him.
Fascinating.
So he said, this is what you should say, this is how you should say it, because you can understand that FDR, this was a month after Hitler had invaded Poland. He had a lot going on. So they had a little bit of time to explain this, but it had huge, huge, huge significance.
All right, so here's a silly question. In her book about her husband,
yes,
Laura was sure that he never once told her anything about what was going on.
You mean during...
Right, while they were at Los Alamos. You couldn't share any of that information even with your wife.
I think there were some wives, as I said, there was a lot of drinking that went on and so on and so forth. And I think there were some wives and some people that demanded more and were constantly nagging and wanted. And I think Laura Fermi had a great deal of respect for her husband, and she understood that she understood intrinsically that this was something of great import, but also understood that he felt it was his patriotic duty, and he was extremely patriotic, loved America, not to speak about it, and she felt it was hers not to ask. They didn't know when the bomb was going to be dropped. August 6th, you know, literally it came, they didn't know. It came over the loudspeaker, you know. And then after that, of course, everyone talked about it. And you had again, reactions, everything from physicists throwing up in the bushes once they realized
the power,
what they had done. And then other people, you know, being very celebratory. And then, of course, as pictures and so forth and the consequences of it came in. Oppenheimer famously said, "I am become death," you know, at Alamogordo. So.
Amazing.
Yeah.
Amazing. Mm-hmm. An amazing period to have lived through and to have been such an intrinsic part of.
Yeah. Yeah.
I don't think enough students recognize all the names of the people who were part of that moment.
Right.
Must have been wonderful to be able to get that involved in Fermi's life and bring that forward.
Yes. And many of the people and colleagues that he had known in Europe were gathered. I mean, in a way, you could say it was the greatest gathering of minds in the 20th century, really. But a lot of his colleagues from his early days in Italy as a professor at the University of Rome were there. Emilio Segre, Emilio Rossetti, and other people that he had known, in Niels Bohr, who he had known and worked with. So it was an amazing conflagration of minds.
And so among that group, I'm going to imagine that one of his early professors was likely a mentor in his own life?
Yes, yes. One of them was, his name was Corbino, and he was the physicist who hired him at the University of Rome, who saw his brilliance and who encouraged him to run the department in the way that he did. As I've mentioned, Lo Sordo was completely against all of this and wanted to go back to more traditional ways. And also, Fermi and Corbino, his mentor, knew all about Einstein and theory of relativity, and they felt that was extremely important to bring to the fore. And they wanted to bring the physics in Italy into the modern age, and other people wanted to keep it back. So Corbino was a huge, huge supporter and mentor, and helped him find the materials that he needed to do what he what he needed, what he wanted to do, and helped him hire colleagues to work with him. And so this little group of Segrais, Rossetti, Fermi, they were called Corbino's boys. And there's wonderful photographs of them. He passed away suddenly about, I think, 5 years into Fermi's time there. And it was very tragic for him because his father had died early. He became sort of a father figure to Fermi. And it was a real tragedy when he died. And Lo Sordo took over the department. And that spurred Fermi to say, I need to move on. That was another reason. You know.
It makes sense.
Yeah.
It makes sense. Wow. Well, the last question I like to ask people is when we think about this concept of mentoring, who would you say have been the mentors in your life?
I would say that the mentors in my life were, one of them was my high school drama teacher, who was a great nephew of Henrik Ibsen, unbelievably, in the middle of Omaha, Nebraska. What the heck, you know? But he had us reading, you know, Ibsen when we were in ninth grade. But more importantly, he encouraged us to write and develop our own plays and our own projects and to research and take charge of our own work. When I think I was in 10th grade, we wrote our own musical and our own piece about the Mormons who spent the winter in Omaha. We researched it and I think it was a very important time in my life, and he was a very important person to me. So I think that was certainly the first person that I think of.
Oh, that's so beautiful. Yeah. Well, teachers are a wonderful thing to use as mentors.
Yes, that is for sure. You know all about that.
Well, hopefully. I want to thank you so much for being with us today. I'm very excited to read the book now, and I'd like to say thank you for coming.
Thank you for having me. It's really been a pleasure.
Thanks for listening to the Mentors Podcast, sponsored by the Barbera Foundation, whose mission is to promote positive change by inspiring others to engage in their community. Your host has been Dr. Roseanne Welch. Our music was composed by Patrick Abate, technical direction by Douglas E. Welch, and Kathleen Childress designed our website. For more information and to read more about the great mentors in history, visit mentorsproject.org and join us for our next conversation.